Yeah, g'day, mate. You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
On the program, we have Opportunity Party leader Kule Wong coming on to talk about a number of topics, including the fuel crisis, homelessness, their election strategy, and student issues. All pretty pertinent, big topics of discussion here in New Zealand at the moment. Good morning to you, Kule. How are you doing?
Good morning, Zach. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. You're down from, I assume, Tamaki Makaurau?
I am. Very happy to be here this weekend because I think we've got the cyclone coming in up north, so I feel very fortunate to be here on this beautiful day.
How are your family preparing for that cyclone?
They are putting down the paddling pool and probably taking a few things out of the backyard. Yeah, I think just making sure that everything's secure and so that the house is safe. Mm-hmm. And making sure that they've not got too many plans to go anywhere.
Mm. How was your house at all affected by the last cyclone that went through, Gabriel?
We had a bit of flooding around the property, but nothing in the house, thankfully. Just more sort of on the street and around sort of under the house and stuff.
Okay. So you can kind of estimate what will happen with...
I think so. Yeah. I mean, high winds, I'm not sure, though. You know, they've warned that things could go flying and stuff like that. So, I mean, there's always a risk, but we can prepare as best we can.
Got to nail down the outdoor trampoline.
You know? Yes.
Yeah. I read that music is a bit of an outlet for you. I wanted to know, what do you play, and do you have any particular favourite New Zealand artists or songs?
Yeah. I've got a very eclectic music taste. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the 90s, so my guilty pleasure is boy bands and girl bands, and if I'm trying to get into a good mood, then that's often what I'll listen to. Also a bit of 90s hip-hop, don't mm-hmm, mind, mm-hmm, as well. Mm-hmm. The thing I really love is live music. I went to Glastonbury 3 times when I was living in the UK.
Wow.
And there was also this cool thing in London called Sofa Sounds, where people would host live musicians in their living room, and you buy a ticket, you don't know where you're going, and they tell you the address on the day. So you show up to like someone's house or a workplace, and they just have like 3 up-and-coming artists that perform a real range of music. And I think it's just that being in the room listening to live music, that's what I love the most. It's just, you know, I could listen to almost any genre, maybe not like really heavy metal, but
fair enough.
Yeah,
really enjoy that. I have my limits with that one as well.
Yeah. And then New Zealand artists, I saw Lord at Glastonbury, which was epic, amazing show. And then obviously 660 is just such an iconic Kiwi sound, particularly again coming back from London when I'd come back and sort of spend a few weeks here over summer to escape the London winter. You'd always end up at a 660 gig somewhere because they're always touring over the summer, and so I have really fond nostalgic memories of that.
And you'd be able to go see their house on Castle Street later today if you so desire. Awesome. I'm glad to hear that you're a big fan of live music. This is another side question, but where's the best place to go see live music in Tamaki Makaurau?
Oh, there's not that many these days. I have been to the Power Station recently. It seems like it's still going strong. I remember going there when I was at university a long time ago for some gigs. I would love to see more venues popping up like that.
Yeah, it'd be awesome. Let's talk Turkey now. We'll have a little discussion about the fuel crisis that's hitting the globe. Governments in South Asia are tackling the oil shock head on. You know, India is cutting fuel taxes on petrol and diesel and redirecting gas to priority users. Many countries, including Sri Lanka and South Korea, are rationing fuel. Thailand is asking people to use their cars less and work from home more. Our government's response has been to secure more fuel. And the only party to put out any real substantive policy plan have been the Greens. Is this demonstrable of a bit of a dim political imagination in New Zealand?
Yeah, and I think it's a failure to be honest and open about the trade-offs. These situations are always difficult, and it's not always clear and easy to have an answer and to know exactly what to do. But what I would really love to see is the government talking about the different options more openly. I think there's a few different areas. So obviously you've got the supply side, which they're focusing a lot on. There's the demand side. So what are the options for limiting the use of certain vehicles or certain industries in order to save fuel if we need to, so that people can start to imagine what that might look like? So diesel, for example, you know, there's a real risk of running out of diesel. And having that open conversation around, you know, we might need to prioritise the industries that need diesel over private vehicles that use it, for example. And I think just starting to have that conversation more openly would be useful. And then the third bucket is supporting those people that do need to purchase fuel, with support, whether that's payments or things like free public transport. So we actually just launched our free public transport policy yesterday. This was actually something we were already planning to do and was in the pipeline, but obviously with the fuel crisis it felt like now is the right time to really push for it. We think the numbers stack up regardless of the fuel crisis. I think it's an important thing and a great step that New Zealand could take. So we're really advocating for that in the short term. And then obviously our longer term energy abundance policy is about making sure that we're more resilient to shocks like this in the future and less reliant on foreign source fossil fuels.
You mentioned communicating there and how this government doesn't feel like they can really be the bearer of bad news, but that's really key to any sort of political or any leadership role, that you have to front up to what's happening in reality.
Yeah, I think so. And that's what creates trust, with citizens. They can see right through it if you're trying to hide something. And, even if it is bad news, putting all of those things on the table and being clear and open and honest about how you're making those decisions creates so much more trust and a sense of security for people.
Completely. This next question is going to be a bit dark, but Luxon said the other day at a post-cabinet conference that while we condemn the bombing of civilian infrastructure and targeting of civilians, the US bombing schools in Iran is up to them to justify. There's no condemnation from our Prime Minister around the US's blatant atrocities in Iran. Is that a stain on our international reputation?
Yeah, I think it's a shame that they've not been able to, we are a country that's prided ourselves on, long-standing bipartisan approach to international relations. And I think it's a clear breach of international law, and we should feel comfortable saying that. I think it is... it's disappointing to not see the Prime Minister make that statement.
Yeah, like if it was Russia and Ukraine doing that, or China with Taiwan doing that, it would be instant. But here it seems like they're a bit reticent to really criticise the US.
And I understand that they're trying to, we, as a small country, we need to have good relationships with lots of different countries, including the US. Just because we condemn a certain act doesn't mean that we can't still
work
support
them,
work with them on other things.
I mean, China's our biggest trading partner, and we're pretty critical of them.
Exactly, yeah. And again, I think it comes down to that openness with the public and being clear on our stance. But that doesn't mean that we need to shy away from the difficult statements that we need to make.
How high on the sort of totem pole is foreign policy for your election strategy or your negotiation strategy? Have you thought very hard about what sort of foreign policy goals you might want to see?
We have thought about it a lot more. I think in the past it's not been a huge pillar of the Opportunity Party's policy platform, but given the global situation, I think it's prudent for us to think about what that means for us. The way that we approach it, there's components of a lot of our policies that feed into our stance on the, in foreign policy, things like energy abundance and local energy resilience, local food system resilience as well. So we are thinking about how we might package some of that up as a more dedicated foreign policy for people to understand our position on these things. I think broadly our principle is, how do we make sure New Zealand can look after itself, and how do we position ourselves on the world stage so that we put ourselves in the best position possible. We're always going to be a small player on the global stage, but we do have strengths around renewable sourced energy, around our innovation and the exports that we send to the world. So how do we leverage those to put ourselves in the best position possible?
Completely. As I mentioned before, there's a bit of a dim political imagination in New Zealand. Lots of people are disillusioned by National because they're a bit mean and they're uninspired by Labour for how incremental their politics have become. How do you operate in the quote-unquote centre while the fringes seem to be growing, and how do you make policy from the centre and tell a vision that excites people and gets people from both sides of the spectrum?
Yeah, I think the thing that's lacking across all parties, whether they're the big ones or the minor ones, is a vision for the future. I don't really know what any of those parties imagine 2050 to be like. I can't really pin it down. And so that's the thing we're really trying to articulate as a party this year. where are we going as a country, particularly for all of those young people who are looking overseas and seeing more opportunity in Australia and other countries. We need to be really clear about where we're going and where we want to be by something like 2050. So I think that's what we can bring to the table. And the solutions, I think, for that long-term vision that we're painting are not going to come from the extremes, and they're also not going to come from the past, which is sort of the status quo that the major parties generally are protecting. It's sort of just a steady as she goes, we'll just keep doing the same old, tinker a little bit around the edges, do nothing radical. We do need to make some big, bold changes, but we don't need to completely overthrow and disrupt the system either. We need to, think long-term and bring some pragmatism into how we deliver on those long-term solutions. Mm.
You mentioned that the solutions won't come from the fringes, but perhaps they'll come from regular people, because your party is big on the idea of citizens' assemblies to have in-person public discourses on pressing issues. On the Opportunity website, you cite how Aucklanders used an assembly to solve difficult water infrastructure challenges. How do you involve citizens' assemblies on a national scale in Aotearoa to ensure people in all areas, whether that's geographical areas, ethnic areas, political areas, are represented?
Yeah, so there are ways, either digitally or doing it by a series of local citizens' assemblies that already exist. So say we did something on tax or superannuation and we wanted to make it a national conversation, because that applies to everyone. We could run kind of mini citizens' assemblies in different communities. And I think the important thing to note with this concept is it only works if you have an accurate representation of that community. So you can't just have whoever wants to show up, who tends to be, you know, the retirees or people with a bit more money and time to spend engaging in these things. That's what we have at the moment with our submission process. Often you see there's a skew towards sort of an older population with more time to make submissions.
Mm, maybe a Caucasian persuasion.
Yes, yeah. Whereas with a citizens assembly, it cannot go forward until you have an accurate representation from that community. So we would make sure that we're doing that all across the country, maybe combine that via a digital platform. People could have the option to engage digitally or in person and really start to build that consensus. I think it would be an amazing thing for New Zealand to do that on something like tax and superannuation.
Completely. Who's going to be the arbiter of the topics you want to discuss, though? Because you might have people wanting to front discussions around low-hanging fruit, like trans people using bathrooms, for instance.
We could. So we are proposing to have a parliamentary commissioner for the citizen's voice, which is what we call it. So they would oversee it generally and recommend which topics get taken to a citizens' assembly. So we're proposing we could do two or three a year, and the commissioner would be in charge of kind of finalising what topic that is. Everyday citizens could put forward an idea for that. So similar to bringing a petition to Parliament, you could bring in a petition for a citizens' assembly, and you would have to get a, you know, requirement of a certain number of signatures to make that recommendation to the commissioner, who would ultimately have their final say, and there would be some criteria around what sorts of topics we think are valuable to discuss within the community.
Awesome. A citizens' assembly on a citizens' assembly.
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, man. Let's talk student issues, because students are having a bit of a hard time at the moment, as most people are. There's horrible housing stock, a lack of jobs after graduating in New Zealand. Weekly income is pretty meagre, and there's a big decline in third spaces around the country. So finding community beyond university is trickier than it once used to be. But the big wallet drain, as I'm sure you know, is rent. What do you make of a rental warrant of fitness like the Greens have put forward, or potentially a rent freeze or a rent cap?
So, yeah, all of those issues are particularly pertinent to students, but are all also symptoms of huge systemic challenges that we are facing in New Zealand. Housing in general is a crisis for the whole country, and we can't continue to build this economy based on expecting our house prices to double every 10 years. It's just not realistic. You know, and I think that is ultimately the cause of high rents, of houses that are below standard for people to be living in, because people are, you know, you've got landlords who just, they don't actually really care about the quality of the house. They're just banking on making some capital gains on that piece of land over the next 10 years. So our solution to that is the land value tax. And we think ultimately that will bring house prices down and make rents more affordable. So things like rent caps and you know, rental warrant of fitness in particular, I think is a good idea. We need to make sure that, you know, the standard of houses is, you know, is much higher than it currently is. But I don't know. I don't think that those things are going to solve the root cause of high rents and high house prices in this country, which is why we need something like a land value tax to tackle that problem properly.
But you wouldn't be against, say, if you were in a coalition with the Greens, you wouldn't be against that idea as a solution, because it's pretty popular with students.
Yeah. I think as a short-term solution, you know, open to having that discussion, I think like a rent cap is just not the long-term sustainable option for solving the problem.
Okay. What is citizens' income? It's an idea that, you know, Opportunity have put forward time and time again, sort of like a UBI, universal basic income. Would it replace student living costs?
It replaces the student allowance. Right. So, and it basically means that every student would receive the student allowance. You wouldn't have to demonstrate your, you know, parents' income level in order to access it. So the value of that is around $19,000 a year, and that's paid to every adult, or almost every adult, over 18. We do have an upper limit in terms of income for who would receive it. So that removes a lot of bureaucracy. There's probably lots of stories out there of students trying to game the system and find the loopholes to get access to that. This gets rid of a lot of that bureaucracy. And yes, there are people that will receive it that don't necessarily need it, but it means that for those that do need it, it is a lot easier. There's more dignity in the process and having to apply for it. You know, that barrier is removed. And it means that students can get on with focusing on what they need to, mm-hmm. like studying, engaging with their community, you know, preparing themselves for their careers. Mm-hmm. You know, we think that it's a really important solution, particularly with the potential loss of jobs through AI and the high unemployment rates that we might be facing over the next decade.
Completely. Homelessness seems to be a massive issue around the country. Mm. And before we get into talking about your approach to homelessness, I do want to ask, how would the citizens' income apply to the homeless? Because they might not be able to fill out any details on a form about where they're living. You know, how could they have access to the citizens' income?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as long as they've got an IRD number, they would be able to. I recognise that that's not everybody is even accessing the system in that way. Mm. So we would really want to be working with those people to make sure that we're getting them off the streets and that we're putting them into housing and that we have them in the system. It then becomes a lot easier to give them access to the citizens' income than the current, you know, trying to get onto the job seeker benefit, going into a WINS office or sitting on a phone for 8 hours a day. They probably don't even have a phone to sit on to wait to talk to someone at MSD. There's some really horrific stories from the Citizens Advice Bureau and the Salvation Army of people trying to access support, and a lot of people that aren't getting it because it's just so difficult at the moment.
Mm. What do you see as sort of some of the root causes of the homelessness crisis? You know, it's 1 in 1,000 people are experiencing housing insecurity, according to the Salvation Army. Do you approach it from an angle of it being a mental health crisis or a housing crisis or an unemployment crisis? What is your sort of opinion there?
All of these things are interconnected, right? It's totally, we can't solve one without the other. We, you know, our health system is crippling, and so those people don't, you know, if they are facing mental health issues, they're not getting seen, so that's how they end up on the street. So we have to tackle all of these issues at the same time. I think at a macro level, we've also seen the economy really stall. We, you know, our productivity is really low, and so we you know, there's less money to go around to support those people as well. So I think where we are tackling this is, you know, our tax policy is around making sure that we can set that minimum floor for people, look after particularly the really vulnerable and those on low incomes. But we've also got some big ideas around how we drive productivity in this country and do it in a way that's going to be sustainable for the long term, and actually, you know, boost GDP growth, create better jobs, more high-value industries, so that when we do pick them up and we support them to get onto a path, there's somewhere for them to go and there are good jobs for them to go to, and safe spaces for them to raise a family. So it is a whole-of-system approach, and it's not going to happen overnight. But that's where we think, you know, we really do need to have honest conversations as Kiwis and come up with some bold ideas and keep moving forward rather than wasting all of our time flip-flopping on things like ferries and hospitals, because that is not going to set these people up for the long term.
Mm. Commit to the bit, you're saying.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned GDP growth, because from what I've seen, what I guess I'm sort of surrounded by in my ecosystem, internet ecosystem, is that, you know, GDP growth is great, but it's not necessarily indicative of wealth redistribution or people's yep. lives getting better.
Yep.
The United States is a pretty great example of that.
Yep.
You know, how do we ensure that GDP growth is actually felt by yep. most working New Zealanders?
Totally. I used to be a trustee of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, so I'm all in that camp of GDP is not the
number go up doesn't
of,
mean yeah, life
it,
go up.
Yeah, it does not equate to increased living standards. You know, our living standards framework that has been developed is a great start, and we should actually use it. It's just sitting there idle at the moment. You know, that looks at all of those different metrics that we should be measuring alongside GDP. So I would really like to see that picked up by the next government, whoever it is. I think, you know, it actually was developed over successive both national and Labor governments. And so I feel like it shouldn't be political. The word well-being has become a little bit political. So maybe we don't need to talk about that, but yeah, we do need to talk about what kind of growth and for what purpose and for who. Like, how does it affect people? And that's where, you know, my background is in sustainable business, the B Corp movement, which is around businesses that balance purpose with profit. And I would love to see a world where every single business is demonstrating how they create a positive benefit for society, whether that's a social or environmental impact. You know, short-term profit for the sake of it should not be a thing. It should not be a license to operate for a business.
Mm-hmm. Last quick question while you're here. You're going to be in Dunedin for a few more days until Tuesday.
Yeah.
Have you got anything that's on the top of your sightseeing or to-do list while you're here?
Well, we're off to visit the new hospital this afternoon, so really interested to speak to some of the people there about some of the challenges that they've faced getting that built, and also the state of our healthcare system in general. So, yeah, it'd be a real privilege to chat to them about that and what we can do about it. I'm also just, yeah, keen to meet a few more opportunity supporters in town. We've got a pub quiz, doing park run on Saturday morning, if there's any runners out there that want to come and join. And obviously the Nature Dome, you know, festival. Dunedin is such a hotspot for wildlife, and really keen to meet people who are working in that space and support the kaupapa there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the program. I really appreciate it and your time. Do you have any final thoughts, words or opinions to leave our listeners with?
Oh, I think if anyone is frustrated with the state of politics at the moment and frustrated with the status quo, voting for any of the current parties is, in my view, the most wasted vote. So we would really love to see your support for the Opportunity Party in 2026, and looking forward to entering Parliament and making a difference.
Crack that 5% threshold.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because
you... Yeah, now, Siebs, that was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.